Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther. Today, we have another great guest, as always. Of course, I'm talking about Professor Yoichiro Sato, who is a professor of international relations at Rexomon Asia Pacific University in Japan. And he and I have known each other a while. And considering what's going on in Asia these days, I thought, who better to come give us a perspective from the Japanese view? Because, you know, if you think about NucleCast episodes, we've really never had a good perspective from what are the Japanese thinking? How do they see it? How do the Japanese look at what's going on in Korea right now? You've got the Chinese are acting increasingly aggressive towards Taiwan, the PLA and the PLA Navy, PLA Air Force. And of course, the new prime minister of Japan recently said that Japan may need to reconsider its own views on nuclear weapons. So there's a lot going on in the Asia Pacific. And of course, Yoichiro has written tremendously about these topics, and he's a great expert in the field. And I thought, who better to get a view from Japan than Yoichiro Sato? So thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting.
So, you know, I sort of broached at least three topics for sure. So as you sit in Japan and you look at what's going on around you in the region, what is the Japanese perspective? How are the Japanese looking at Korea and looking at Taiwan and looking at the PRC? And what are you thinking? What are the considerations? What are the, you know, the discussions that you have amongst yourselves?
I think Japanese see that the security environment surrounding Japan has quickly deteriorated during the past decade. And it started with the very active the Chinese activities within the 200 nautical miles of the Senkaku Islands, which China also claims as theirs. And also the prolonged confrontation over North Korea's nuclear weapons development. In that policy field also, North Korea has been testing newer types of missiles. And this appears to be quickly improving North Korea's capability to actually deliver the warheads. And this is the growing concern for Japan. The relationship with Russia was pretty stable even after the Russian annexation of Crimea, because former Prime Minister Abe tried to keep it low profile and continue to negotiate the territorial dispute over the northern islands between Russia and Japan. But since the Russian invasion into Ukraine, this has changed as Prime Minister Kishida decided to take a tougher stance in line with the friends and allies in Europe and the United States. So since then, the Russia approached China and started to threaten Japan with, for example, naval maneuvering, joint naval exercise between Russia and China, and, you know, the circling around the Japanese mm-hmm. archipelago and so forth. So all those are really contributing to the worsening perception about the security environment surrounding Japan. And yeah. I probably should also mention that tension escalating over the Taiwan Straits, and the China is really negatively responding to the election of the new Taiwanese president. And mm-hmm. this has resulted in more frequent military exercises by China, and the U.S. And Japan increasingly discussing the possible contingency scenarios.
Yeah, so as you look at the threat environment and you look towards North Korea and then you think about China, for Japan, does it look to North Korea and say this is the biggest threat, or does it look to China and say this is the biggest threat? How does it, is you're thinking about positionally which threat you have to worry about most, how do you evaluate that?
I think the biggest threat is China, and North Korea is developing nuclear weapons, but you know, North Korean leaders know that the moment they actually use it, that's like committing a suicide, because massive retaliation will simply, you know, destroy North Korea. So as long as North Koreans see it as a deterrence, then there are ways to diplomatically wiggle through. Whereas China appears to be on the course of a kind of long-term challenge at the global leadership which the United States currently holds, and the period of leadership transition, as the China sees, and I think some in the U.S. also sees, is the period of instability, and it is Japan who is kind of stuck between this growing competition and trying to create enough diplomatic space to wiggle through this difficult time.
So do you, is, you know, you're, the Prime Minister recently said that Japan needed to reconsider its views on nuclear weapons. When you heard that, what was your take on that? Was that something that you said, we knew this was coming, or were you sort of shocked, or, you know, what did that mean? What was your take, and what is sort of the Japanese society writ large? Are they shaking their heads saying, yeah, that's right? Or are they saying, you know, who did we elect? What's sort of the general perspective?
I think in the general public, the anti-nuclear sentiment is still very strong. And, you know, of course, this originated in the experiences in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And public in general is very much against nuclear weaponization of Japan as such. But at the same time, the security environment deteriorates rather quickly, and there has been discussions about, for example, the nuclear sharing with the United States, just like some European states did during the Cold War, and you know, continued to this date. But that, of course, remains within the private discussion among some of the ruling party members. It doesn't have a widespread support as of now. The main factor behind some of those comments indicating a possibility of Japan going nuclear is most likely a response to Korea. A similar talk is happening in South Korea, and the conservatives who are really sick and tired of North Korean blackmailing diplomacy started talking about nuclearization, but it's really alarming that now, as the conservatives are appearing to be losing power again, and a possibility of yet another progressive leadership coming into Korea, this new progressive leadership is so pro-North that they might actually be looking at reunified Korean Peninsula under very strong leadership of the North. And, having a combined nuclear weapon strength between North and South, that would be a nightmare scenario for Japan. And I think Japan is feeling a need to send a sort of warning against that kind of a really negative prospect over the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you say that, because we've sort of watched President Yoon, the president of South Korea, reach out to Japan to try to rebuild relations. And it's interesting because he is sort of the conservative, and it's the progressives that Japan is most worried about because of their very pro-northern perspective. And I've never heard until you mentioned this that there's even contemplation of a unified Korea, absent war, a unified Korea in which, a progressive government reunifies, and then who knows what that would look like subsequently. It would be, far more challenging than the unification of Germany. But for the Japanese, that would be a very difficult situation. And do you think that if something like that happened, right, this is sort of our low probability but high threat scenario, do you think that would be sufficient to, sort of radically change the public perspective in Japan in regards to nuclear weapons? Or do you think most people would take sort of a wait and see attitude to see how this new unified Korea interacted with Japan?
Right. I think there are many other variables involved, but probably the most important variable is what the new unified Korea would do about the U.S.-South Korean alliance. And if they decide to completely cut it off and, go to the side of China and or Russia with the nuclear weapons of their own, that would be, in a way, very problematic, but also it kind of simplifies things, because Japan can still remain under the U.S. nuclear umbrella and see Russia, China, and the Korean Peninsula as a joint and common threat to Japan and the United States. So in that kind of scenario, actually the current nuclear deterrence probably holds, and Japan may not have to think about its own nuclear weapons. But I think a more complex scenario would be South Korea going nuclear, not fully unified with North Korea yet, but having a very friendly relationship with the North, and stay in the alliance with the U.S., but really minimize its commitment to the alliance and takes a very high degree of a hedging attitude. That kind of creates a really complex situation for Japan to deal with, and it would be under such a complex scenario that Japan may have to think about developing its own nuclear force.
Now, we're at that time in the show where we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to pose the question and maybe give you time over the break to think about this. Is American deterrence credibility, is it weakening? Is it strengthening? Is it holding steady? As we do this sort of dance with, the United States with its ally, Japan, how are the Japanese looking at this relationship and American credibility? Are they saying, man, the Americans are, sort of in decline? Or what's the Japanese perspective? So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Yoichiro Sato about Japanese perspectives on Asian security. And I posed a question to you about American credibility, and I'm interested. What is your answer? How are we seen by the Japanese?
Yeah, I think the credibility of the alliance has gone up and down from time to time. And I think it was really high in the aftermath of the Eastern Japan great earthquake and the recovery process. I think it was a time the alliance was really felt at the grassroots level, where people witnessed what the U.S. alliance meant for Japan's security with their own eyes. You know, when the U.S. Military came in and cleaned up the flooded Sendai airport within just matter of a few days, and started accepting air cargo for relief goods, and that happened in concurrence with the self-defense force clearing up the highways and restoring the transportation between Tokyo and Sendai. All those things were felt by the people, and I think the perception about the alliance really improved at the time. I think it was problematic when President Trump came and he started what he calls transactional diplomacy towards allies and friends. For example, he mentioned about renegotiating the host nation support for the cost of U.S. military stationing in Japan. And, he mentioned specific figures like, Japan should pay four times more. Well, I mean, currently Japan's paying half of the cost. So if Japan pays four times more, the U.S. start making profits. And, something like that really hurt the credibility of the United States as an ally. And maybe Trump is simply, starting the negotiation from a high position and, ready to come down and so forth. But
then then you feel like right. You've gotten a deal.
Yeah. I mean, everything seems to be a sort of game to him. And But this is very frustrating for Japan. And Japan was really fortunate to have a very capable diplomatic prime minister like Abe, who could, you know, manage the relationship with President Trump. But, you know, under Ishiba, that would be more difficult because of the lack of this sort of personal relationship. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you know, going back to the credibility issue, one thing the U.S. Often forgets is Japan's geopolitical significance as a country located on the really eastern periphery of the Eurasian continent, in a location where containing the naval accesses of China and Russia into the open Pacific, it requires a strong forward deployment on the Japanese archipelago. And this significance is indeed a contribution to the U.S. security. So, you know, the Trump rhetoric that, oh, we are paying for Japan's defense, blah, 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 you know, that doesn't sell in Japan. And U.S. needs to realize that, you know, having bases on Japan is such a great luxury and gift. And when U.S. forgets that, this really hurts the credibility of the alliance.
And as you look at sort of the nuclear component of that alliance, are you looking at China's growing nuclear arsenal and saying, and looking to the U.S. and saying, okay, are you going to expand yours as well? Or do you look and say, well, they, you know, China can double or triple it, but the U.S. still has enough to destroy China's major cities, so it doesn't really matter. How do you look at that, you know, that changing dynamic?
I think so far, you know, the balance of intercontinental ballistic missiles between the U.S. and China overwhelmingly favored the United States, and this is not going to change overnight. But the real immediate threat is China's deployment of intermediate range missiles, which are capable of hitting Japan and some of the U.S. forward bases like Guam and Okinawa and also you know, Korean Peninsula and Southeast Asia as well. So the most likely use of those missiles by China is not necessarily nuclear, but China will use those missiles for kind of access deniability. And China tries to turn the East China Sea and South China Sea into, you know, safe lakes for Chinese ships and submarines. And that is a real danger. And Japan's already responding to this threat by, you know, developing a longer range ground attack, surface attack capabilities so that, you know, that this imbalance of intermediate range missiles in East Asia will be somewhat rectified.
Do you think there's any movement? You know, I've had the chance to attend some ASEAN summits, and as I look, I'll never forget, you know, I was at there was one in San Francisco. This might have been 10 years ago. And, you know, all of the nations spoke English as sort of the common language, except the Chinese delegate. And the Chinese delegate, you know, who spoke English perfectly well, would only speak, you know, Mandarin and then have a translator next to him. And so To me at that time, I was like, this is China asserting its power and size in the region. And I've always wondered, and I've never really gotten a good answer. Do you see any collaboration between the smaller, South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, as they've watched, because they've all been watching China assert itself in the South China Sea, East China Sea. Has there been a movement towards those other countries working more collectively to, at whatever the right time is, to push back on China? Or is there still a lot of efforts to bilaterally work independent relationships with China?
That's a good question. They're doing all of those. I mean, they will never cut the bilateral ties with China. But at the same time, they are also cultivating new bilateral security partnerships with Japan, with the U.S., with European Union, with Australia, and with India. So that's happening as well. But multilaterally, the Southeast Asians are not unified in terms of how to deal with China. But some of the kind of forward-looking countries, like the Philippines, is very closely working with Quad member states. So the joint naval exercise in the South China Sea between the Philippine Navy and the Quad Navies minus India was quite significant. But also with India, the Philippines introduced the BrahMo missiles from India. So the relationship is growing there. The Vietnam, I think, was another kind of forward-moving country, very rapidly narrowing the gap with the United States and inviting U.S. aircraft carriers for port call. And, a lot happened during the Trump administration and into the Biden administration as well. But all the while, Vietnam has always made sure to assure the Chinese leaders that, this is just a part of many partnerships Vietnam has, and Vietnam-China relationship remains of the top importance and so forth. So in that sense, I think most Southeast Asian countries are hedging their bets.
Yeah, that's it makes sense. It really does. So now we're at that time in the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie, and as I rub my magic lamp, Bob offers all of our guests on Nuclecast 3 wishes. The only requirement is those wishes have to be related to the topics we've been discussing. So you can't wish for great wealth or the fountain of youth, anything like that. You got to wish for things related to our topics of discussion. So let me ask you, Yoichiro Sato, what is your first wish?
My first wish is most immediate. The South Korea remains in the hands of conservative leadership. That's my first wish.
Yeah, that's a good one for Japan, as we've discussed.
The second wish, can I do the second wish?
Sure, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, second wish, that Donald Trump appoints new cabinet members based on the competence rather than loyalty. That's my second wish. I'm really afraid that he becomes king without clothes. He needs good advisors.
Yeah, always, for sure. Okay, now you get a third wish. You got one more.
My third wish, the Xi Jinping's leadership weakens in China and moderate factions prevail over his personal ambition.
That's a good one. Now, as we, you know, we're coming to the end of the show, and for our audience, which is, you know, it tends to be Americans in the nuclear enterprise, whether they be military, the Department of Energy, the labs, that tends to be our general audience. And so as you sort of leave our general audience with a parting message that they should understand about Japan and, you know, Japan's position and Japan's view of the world, what is it you would want to get across to that American audience?
Okay. There are voices in the U.S. that the U.S. can deter China from a long distance, and they tend to put less values on the forward deployment. But the forward deployment significance is the credibility of the alliance, the fact that the U.S. soldiers are in the front line risking their own lives does matter in terms of the credibility perception. So for that reason, both Japanese and U.S. need to work very closely together to maintain a healthy level of forward deployment presence. And this, you know, falls on both shoulders of the Japanese leaders and American leaders, because Japan has domestic issues with, you know, the base presence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Yoichiro Sato, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us, and we will see you next time. You know, we've never had a guest come on to talk, you know, the Japanese perspective. And so it was good to hear from Yoichiro about how the Japanese think about, you know, security issues in the region. So I enjoyed it, you know, and, you know, he's a very thoughtful guy. You know, he's been around, I've known him quite a while. And so I've always thought he was thoughtful. And it's always interesting to hear them talk, to get their take on American politics, because, you know, he talked about that. So it was an interesting interview. I enjoyed it. Hopefully you did as well.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.